Well, first of all we have to see the formation of the world, and then the arrival of the gardeners of the world. They will come and look around, survey the place and all that, and then they will go away to plan, and later still you will see them arrive in a huge spaceship because that is really what the moon is. Suddenly all was dark, the darkest darkness that I had ever experienced. Even on a moonless night there had been dim starlight, and even in a closed room with no windows there was still an impression of a little light. But here there was nothingness, not a thing. And then I nearly jumped off my seat, I nearly jumped out of my robe with fright. With incredible speed two faint dots of light were coming together, and they hit, they collided, and then the screen was filled with light. I could see swirling gases and smokes of different colors, and then the whole screen, the whole globe filled everything. I could see rivers of fire running down from flame-belching volcanoes. The atmosphere was almost turgid. I was aware, but dimly, that I was watching something and that I wasn't actually there in person. So I watched and was more and more fascinated as the world shrank a little and the volcanoes became less, but the seas were still smoking with the hot lava which had poured in. There was nothing except rocks and water. There was only one stretch of land, not a very large stretch of land, but just one solid lump, and it gave to the globe a peculiar erratic motion. It did not follow a circular path but seemed to be following a path which some shaky child had drawn. Gradually as I watched the world became rounder and cooler. Still there was nothing but rock and water, and terrible storms which raged across the surface. The wind pushed over the tops of mountains, and those tops fell down the mountain sides and were ground into dust. Time elapsed, and by now the earth covered part of the world because the earth itself was made by the ground up dust from the mountains. The land heaved and shook, and from certain parts there came great gouts of smoke and steam, and as I watched I saw a section of land suddenly break off from the main continental mass. It broke off and for seconds it seemed to hang on to the main mass in a vain hope of being reunited. I could see animals slithering down the slopping banks and falling into the steaming water. Then the broken piece cracked more, it broke off completely and disappeared beneath the waves. Somehow I found that I could see the other side of the world at the same time, and I saw, to my unutterable amazement, land rising out of the sea. It rose up like a giant hand rising it, it rose up, shook a bit, and then quivered to a standstill. This land, of course, was just rock, not a plant, not a blade of grass, and nothing like trees. And then, as I watched, a mountain nearby burst into flames. Lurid flames, red, yellow and blue, and then there came a flow of lava, white hot, flowing like a stream of hot water. But as soon as it touched the water it gelled and solidified, and soon the surface of the bare rock was covered by a rapidly cooling mass of a yellow blue. I looked up in wonder, and I wondered where my guide had gone. He was there just behind me, and he said, "Very interesting, Lobsang, very interesting, eh? We want to see a lot more, so we will skip the bit where the barren earth shook and writhed under the cooling by space. When we return we shall see the first types of vegetation." I sat back in my chair, and I was absolutely amazed. Was this really happening? I seemed to be a god looking down at the birth of the world. I felt peculiar because this world in front of me seemed larger than the world I knew, and I seemed to be possessed of remarkable powers of vision. I could see the flames eating out the center of the world so that it would be a hollow world, something like a ball, and all the time as I watched there fell upon the surface of the earth meteorites, cosmic dust, and strange, strange things. Before me, quite within my touch, I thought, there fell some machine. I could not believe this at all because the machine was ripped open and bodies fell out, bodies and machinery, and I thought to myself, in some footrage someone might come across this wreckage and wonder what caused it, wonder what it was. My guide spoke, "Yes, Lobsang, that's already been done. In this present age coal miners have come across truly remarkable things. Artifacts of a skill unknown on this earth, and then also there has come to light in coal some very strange instruments, and in one ease the complete skeleton of a very tall, very big man. You, Lobsang, and I are the only ones to see this because before the machine was quite completed, the gods known as the gardeners of the world had quarreled over women, and so we can only see the formation of this, our Earth. If the machine had been completed, we would have been able to see on other worlds as well. Wouldn't that have been a marvelous thing? The meteorites rained down raising splashes of water when they touched that liquid, and causing bad indentation when they hit rock or the rudimentary soil which at that time covered the earth. The llama moved his hand to another button switches, I suppose they were really called, and the action speeded up so fast that I could not see what it was, and then it slowed down again. I saw a lush azure face on the world. There were vast ferns larger than trees towering up toward the sky now covered with purple cloud, and causing the air itself to be of a purple hue. It was fascinating at first to see a creature breathing in and then exhaling what looked like purple smoke. But I soon got tired of that, or soon got accustomed to it, and I looked further. There were ghastly monsters, incredible things which trod their stolid way through marshlands and bog. It seemed as if nothing could stop them. One vast creature, I haven't the vaguest idea what it was called, came across a whole group of slightly smaller creatures. They would not move, and the larger one would not stop, so he just lowered his head and with a massive spike of bone on what I suppose was his nose he just tripped his way through the other animals. The damp soil was strewn with blood, intestines, and other things of a like nature, and as these parts of the animals fell to the ground there emerged from the water peculiar things with six legs and jaws shaped like two shovels. These are things tucked into all the food they found, and then looked about them for more. Yes, there was one of them imps who had fallen over a log, or something, and broken a leg. The others all sat upon him and ate him alive, leaving only the bones to bear evidence of what had happened. But soon the bones were covered with foliage which had grown, flourished and withered, and fallen to the ground. Millions of years later this would be a coal seam and the bones of the animal would be dug up and be a seven-day wonder. The world spun on, faster now because things were developing more quickly. The llama Miniodon upstretched out to another switch and with his left elbow he jabbed me in the ribs and said, "Lobsang, Lobsang, are you sure you are not asleep? This you must see. Now stay awake and watch." He switched on whatever it was, it might be called a picture but it was three-dimensional, one could get behind it without any apparent effort. The llama dug me in the ribs and pointed up at the purple sky. There was the gleam of silver, a long silver tube closed at both ends was slowly descending. At last it was clear of the purple clouds, and it hovered many feet above the land, and then, as though it had come to a sudden great decision, it dropped gently to the surface of the world. For a few minutes it just stayed there, motionless. One had the impression of some wary animal looking about before leaving the safety of its covering. At last the creature seemed to be satisfied, and a great section of metal fell from the side and hit the ground with a soggy clang. A number of peculiar creatures appeared in the opening and looked about them. They were about twice the height of a tall man, and twice as broad, but they seemed to be covered in some sort of garment which covered them from head to foot. The head part was quite transparent. We could see the stern, autocratic faces of the people inside. They seemed to be poring over a map and making notations as they did so. At last they decided that everything was all right. And so one by one they dropped onto the big piece of metal which had fallen to the ground but which yet remained attached to the vessel by one side. These men were covered in some sort of sheath or protective clothing. One of the men, I guessed that they were men although it was hard to say through all the smoke and the difficulty of seeing past their transparent head pieces, but one of them stepped off the big sheet of metal and fell flat on his face in the murk. Almost before he had touched the surface, vile-looking creatures dashed out of the vegetation and attacked him. His comrades lost no time in producing some sort of a weapon from the belt they wore. Quickly the man was pulled back onto the sheet of metal, and it was seen that the covering of the body was badly torn, apparently by animals, and red blood was flowing. Two of the men carried him aboard the ship, or whatever it was, and several minutes later they came out again carrying something in their hands. They stood on the metal sheet and both pushed a button on an instrument that they were carrying, and flame came out from a pointed nozzle. All the insect things on the sheet curled up into a burning crisp, and were swept off the metal sheet, which then closed up into the body of the ship. The men with the flames moved cautiously around, playing the flames on the floor or on the ground, and burning quite a swathe of earth on one side of the ship. Then they switched off their flames and hurried after the other men who had gone through a forest of ferns. These ferns were as big trees, and it was easy to follow the passage of men through them because apparently they had some sort of cutting device which just swung from side to side and cut the fern down almost to ground level. I decided I must try to see what it was they were doing. I moved from my seat and went a little way left. There I got a better viewpoint because now I could see the men apparently coming toward me. In front of the other men, two men held some machine which glided along and cut down all the fern that got in its way. It seemed to have a rotating blade, and soon they broke through the forest of fern and found an open space in which a number of animals were gathered. The animals looked at the men and the men looked at the animals. One man thought he would test their aggressiveness, so he pointed a metal tube at them and pulled on a little spur of metal. There was a tremendous explosion, and the animal at which the weapon had been pointed just fell to pieces, just collapsed. It reminded me of a monk who had fallen from the top of a mountain, everything was so scattered. But of the other animals there was no sign, they took off too quickly. "We'd better move on a bit," Lob sang. "We've got a lot of ground to cover and we will speed up for about 1,000 years. The llama moved one of those switch knobs, and everything in the globe swirled around like a whirlpool, and eventually it came to its natural rate of rotation. "This is a more suitable time," Lob sang. "You'd better observe carefully because we will see how these caves were made." We looked very carefully and we saw a very low ridge of hills, and as they revolved closer to us we saw that it was rock covered in green mossy material, except for the very top, and that top just showed bare rock. Off to one side we saw some strange houses, they seemed to be half round. If you cut a ball in half and you put the half that has been cut on the ground, then you would have some idea of what these buildings were like. We looked at them and saw people moving about. They were clad in some material which clung to their bodies and left no doubt as to which sex was which. But now they had the transparent headpiece off, and they were talking to each other, and there seemed to be quite a lot of quarreling going on. One of the men was apparently the chief. He brusquely gave some words and a machine came out of one of the shelter places and moved towards the rocky ridge. One of the men moved forward and sat on a metal seat at the back of the machine. Then the machine moved forward, emitting something from nozzles all along the front, the forward part, the bottom and the sides, and as the machine moved slowly forward the rock melted, and seemed to shrink inside itself. The machine emitted ample light so we could see it was boring a tunnel right into the living rock. It moved on, and then it started to circle, and in the space of a few hours it had excavated the big cave into which we first entered. It was an immense cave, and we could see that it was really a hatment or hangar arch for some of their machines which were flying about all the time. It all seemed most puzzling to us. We forgot all about time, we forgot all about being hungry or thirsty, and then, when the great chamber was finished, the machine followed a path which had apparently been marked on the floor, and that path was converted into one of the corridors. It went on and on and on, out of our sight. But then other machines came in, and in the corridors they excavated rooms of different sizes. They seemed to melt the rock. It seemed just to melt and then push its way back, leaving a surface as smooth as glass. There was no dust and no dirt, just this gleaming surface. As the machines did their work, gangs of men and women moved into the rooms carrying boxes and boxes and more boxes, but the boxes all seemed to float in the air. Certainly they were no effort to lift. But an overseer stood in the center of a room and pointed to where each box should be deposited. Then when the room had its full complement of the boxes, the workers started unpacking some of them. There were strange machines and all manner of curious objects, one I recognized as being a microscope. I had seen a very crude one before because at one time the Dalai Lama had been given one from Germany, and so I knew the principle of the thing. We were attracted by a brawl which seemed to be taking place. It was as if some of the men and women were opposed to the other men and women. There was much shouting, much gesticulation, and at last a whole collection of men and women got into some of these vehicles which traveled through the air. They said no goodbyes or anything like that, they just got inside and a door was closed, and the machines went up into the air. A few days later, the days according to the speed of the globe we were watching, a number of the ships came back, and they hovered above the encampment. Then the bottom of the ships opened and things fell out. We looked and we could see people running with desperate speed away from where the things would fall. Then they threw themselves flat on the ground as the first object hit the ground and exploded in a violent brilliant flash of purple. We had difficulty in seeing because we were absolutely dazzled by the brilliant flash, but then from the forest of ferns there came thin shafts of brilliant light. They moved about, and one of the shafts struck one of the machines in the air. Immediately, it vanished in a burst of flame. You see, Lobsang, even the gardeners of the earth had their problems. Their problems were sex, there were too many men and too few women, and when men have been away from women for a long time, well, they get lustful and they resort to great violence. There is no point in us watching this because it is just a case of murder and rape. After a time a lot of the ships departed, apparently to their mother ship which was circling the globe far out in space. After some days a number of big ships came and landed, and heavily armored men came out and they started hunting their fellows through the foliage. Whoever they saw they shot without asking any questions, shot, that is, if the person was male. If she was female they captured her and carried her off to one of the ships. We had to stop. The pangs of hunger and thirst were pressing too much. So we had our ordinary tsampa and water, and having got through that and done a few other things we returned to the chamber which had the globe which appeared to be the world. The Lama Minyadon up switched on something, and we saw the world again. There were creatures on it now, creatures about 4 feet tall and very, very bandy. They had weapons of a sort consisting of a piece of stick at one end of which was lashed a sharp stone which they made sharper by chipping away until there was a really sharp edge. There were a number of the men making these weapons, and others were making weapons of a different kind. They seemed to have a strip of leather, and in it they placed large stones. 2 men drew back the leather loop which was saturated in water to make it stretchable, and they together released the loop. A stone would go soaring away towards the enemy. But we were more interested in seeing how civilizations changed, so the Lama Minyadon up worked his controls again and everything became obscure in the globe. It seemed to be several minutes before there was a gradual lightening as of the dawn slowly appearing, and then there was normal daylight again and we saw a mighty city with tall spires and minarets. From tower to tower there stretched flimsy-looking bridges. It was a marvel to me that they could support themselves let alone take traffic. But then I saw that all the traffic was aerial traffic. Of course, a few people walked about on the bridges and on the different levels of street, but then all of a sudden we heard a thunderous roar. It did not dawn on us for a moment that it came from the three-dimensional globe, but we looked intently and we could see minute specks coming towards the city. Just before reaching the city the minute specks circled and dropped things from their undersides. The mighty city collapsed. The towers were shorn off, the bridges crumpled up like pieces of string too knotted and twisted to be of any use. We saw bodies falling out of the higher buildings. We guessed they must have been the leading citizens because of their dress and because of the quality of the furnishings which fell with them. We looked on dumbly. We saw another lot of little dark dots coming from the other direction, and they engaged the invading dots with unparalleled ferocity. They seemed to have no regard at all for their own life, they would shoot things at the enemy and if that failed to bring them down then the defenders would dive direct onto these, well, I can only call them big bombers. The day ended and night fell upon the scene. The night lightened by mighty flares as the city burned. Flames were breaking out everywhere, from the other side of the globe we could see cities there, in flames, And when the light of an early dawn shone upon the scene with the blood-red sun following on, we saw just heaps of wreckage, just piles of dust, and distorted metalwork. The Lama Miniadon up said, "Let us skip a bit, we don't want to see all this, Lobsang, because you, my poor friend, will be seeing this in actual life before your span on this world is terminated. The globe that was the world spun on. Darkness to light, light to darkness, I forgot how many times the globe spun, or perhaps I never did know, but at last the Lama put out his hand and the swirling globe slowed to its normal rate. We looked carefully this way and that way, and then we saw men with bits of wood in the shape of a plow. Horses were dragging the plows through the ground, and we saw building after building just topple into the trench dug by the plow. For day after day they went on with their plowing until there was no sign that there had ever been a civilization in this area." The Lama Miniadon up said, "I think that is enough for today, Lobsang. Our eyes will be too tired to do anything tomorrow, and we want to watch this because this is going to happen time after time until, in the end, battling warriors will almost exterminate all life on the world. So let us just get some food and retire for the night." I looked up in surprise. "Night, master?" I said, "but how do we know what time it is?" The Lama pointed to a little square a fair way off the ground, perhaps as tall as three men standing on each other's shoulders. There was a hand there, a pointer, and on what appeared to be a tiled background there were certain divisions of light and darkness, and the hand now was pointing between the lightest light and the darkest dark. "There you are, Lobsang," said the Lama, "a new day has almost started. Still, we have plenty of time to rest. I am going to stand in the Fountain of Youth again because my legs are hurting quite a bit. I think I must have scraped the bone very badly as well as lacerating the flesh." "Master, master," I said, "let me attend to it for you." I sped into the room of the fountain and hoisted up my robes. Then the water started to come, and I moved the little thing which the Lama had called a tap. I moved it so that the water kept on flowing after I got out, and I turned another tap thing which I had been told admitted a lot of medicated paste into the water, where it rapidly dissolved and swirled around with the water. The Lama sat on the edge of the pool, and then swung his legs over and into the water. "Ah," he said, "that feels better. This brings great relief, Lobsang. Soon my legs will be quite normal again and this will be just something to talk over with wonder." I rubbed his legs briskly, and little bits of scar tissue came off until at last there was no scar tissue left and his legs again looked normal. "That looks better, sir," I said. "Do you think you have had enough for now?" "Yes, I am sure I have. We don't want to keep at it half the night, do we? We will make that do for now and go in search of food." So saying, he climbed out of the pool and I turned the big wheel thing which let all the water flow away somewhere. I watched until the basin was quite empty, and then I turned on the tap full just to flush away bits of scar tissue. With that gone, I turned the taps off again and went in search of the Lama. "We've done enough for today, Lobsang," said my guide. "I vote that we have tsampa and water for our supper, and then we go to sleep. We will eat better in the morning." So we sat down on the floor in the usual lotus position, and we spooned out the tsampa. Now we felt ultra sophisticated. We were not taking our tsampa scooped up by our fingers, we were using a civilized implement which, by the illustration in one of the books, was called a spoon. But before I could finish my supper I fell over backwards, dead to the world again, sound asleep, and the world rolled on and on. Chapter 6. I sat up suddenly in the darkness, wondering wherever I was. As I sat up the light came on gradually, not like lighting a candle where you get darkness one moment and a glimmer of light the next. This came on like the dawn, so there was no strain to the eyes. I could hear the Lama Miniadon up pottering about in the kitchen. He called out to me and said, "I am preparing breakfast for you, Lobsang, because you will have to eat stuff like this when you move to the western part of the world, just as well to get used to it now," and he laughed with secret glee. I got up and started to make my way to the kitchen. Then I thought, no, nature comes first, and so I reversed my direction of travel so that nature could come first. With that safely accomplished, I went back to the kitchen and the llama was just putting some stuff on a plate. It was a sort of brownish-reddish stuff, and there were also two eggs, fried, I suppose they were, but in those early days I had never before eaten fried food. So he got me sitting at a table and he stood behind me. "Now, Lobsang, this thing is a fork. You take the fork in your hands and hold down the piece of bacon while you cut it with the knife held in your right hand. Then, having cut it in half, you use the fork to convey the piece of bacon to your mouth." "What a darn stupid idea," said I, picking up the bacon with finger and thumb and thereby getting a rap across the knuckles from the llama. "No, no, no, Lobsang. You are going to the West on a special task, and you've got to live as they live, and for that you've got to learn how to do it now. Pick up that bacon with your fork and convey it to your mouth, and then put it in your mouth and withdraw the fork."
"I can't, sir," I said.
"Can't? And why cannot you do as I say?" the llama asked. "Well, sir, I had that stuff to my mouth and you gave me a rap across the knuckles which made me let go, so I've eaten the wretched stuff. You have the other half there, look. Pick it up with your fork and convey it to your mouth. Put it well inside your mouth and then withdraw the fork." So I did that, but it did seem such a stupid idea. Why should anyone have to have a bit of bent metal to convey food to his mouth? It was about the craziest thing I had heard, but here was even worse. "Now work the concave part of the fork under one of those eggs, and then cut with a knife so that you have about a quarter of the egg on the fork. You then put it to your mouth and eat it." "Do you mean to say that if I go to the West I've got to eat in this crazy fashion?" I asked the llama.
"I certainly do mean that, so it's just as well for you to get used to it now. Fingers and thumbs are very useful for a certain grade of people, but you are supposed to be superior material. What do you think I am bringing you to a place like this for?"
"Well, sir, we fell in the wretched place by accident," I said.
"Not so, not so," said the llama.
"We came in by accident, yes, admittedly so, but this was our destination. You see, the old hermit was the keeper of this place. He had been the keeper for about 50 years, and I was bringing you to expand your education a bit. But I think that fool on the rock must have knocked all your brains out."
"I wonder how old these egg things are," said the llama thoughtfully. He put down his knife and fork and went to the container where the eggs were kept, and I saw him counting noughts.
"Lobsang, these eggs and this bacon are about 3 million years old, and they taste as fresh as if the eggs had been laid only yesterday. I played about with the egg and the rest of the bacon. I was puzzled. I had seen things decay even when packed in ice, and now I was told I was eating stuff about 3 million years old. Master, I have so many puzzlements, and the more you tell me the more questions you raise in my mind. You say these eggs are about 3 million years old, and I agree with you, they really are like fresh laid eggs, no trace of deterioration, so how is it possible for these to be 3 million years old?"
"Lobsang," said the llama, "it would need a very abstruse explanation to really satisfy you about certain of these things, but let us look at it in a way which is not strictly accurate but which should give you some idea of what I mean. Now, supposing you have a collection of blocks. These blocks, we will call them cells, can be assembled to form different things. If you were playing as a child you could make block houses from these little cubes, and then you could knock over your house and make something quite different. Well, bark on, eggs or anything else, is composed of little blocks, little cells which have unending life because matter cannot be destroyed. If matter could be destroyed the whole universe would come to a halt. So nature arranges that these particular blocks are made into a shape which represents bacon, and those particular blocks represent eggs. Now, if you eat the bacon and the eggs you are not wasting anything because even to Ali all this passes through you, undergoing chemical changes on the way, and eventually it gets out to the land, or the earth, where it nourishes newly growing plants. And then perhaps a pig or a sheep will come along and eat the plants, and grow bigger. So everything depends on these blocks, these cells. You may get cells which are oval, and we will say, that is the natural type of cell. It enables a person to be built who is shapely, slender, and perhaps tall. That is because the cells, the oval cells, are all laid in one direction.